You're listening to the Vermont Edition podcast. This is Meg Malone, the Vermont Edition digital producer, just here to let you know that this episode has been edited for clarity and brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. One of the early guiding principles of the internet was that everyone should have access to it. For many people, that idea also means that internet providers like Verizon or Comcast or wherever you get your internet service from shouldn't be able to pick and choose how easy it is for you to access certain sites or services. That idea was actually put into federal law in 2015, but it's still been a big source of debate. And yesterday, the FCC submitted recommendations to the White House to roll back the rules it enacted 2 years ago. The FCC proposed this rollback idea in May and opened up a public comments period, and it got 9 million responses from people with very strong opinions before the comments period ended earlier this week. Vermont's delegation has weighed in on this idea, and it's something many Vermonters feel strongly about. So we're going to discuss it today, starting out with a little bit of an explainer for those of us who scratch our heads on what net neutrality actually means every time we hear it come up in the news. Kip Steele is here to help us out with that. He's part of the IT team at UVM Health Network, and he's here to share some of his knowledge. Kip, it's a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so the broad concept is that internet providers shouldn't be able to dictate what you see or the speed at which it gets to you. So how does that 2015 net neutrality ruling enforce this idea, or the rules, rather?
So it basically describes what is an open internet, saying that the resources and access aren't limited. I can't specifically target or say that individuals going to a specific content site will be slower than others, other sites that they're going to, that you're not allowed to do that. You can't enforce laws or rules.
Okay, so in other words, whatever provider I'm using, if I want to go to Netflix or Facebook or Google or whatever site I want to go to, I should be able to go to all of those at the same speed. Nobody's sort of dictating or trying to direct me to one or the other.
That's correct.
So if this is, for many people, a guiding principle of the internet, this idea of freedom of choice, freedom of access, why wasn't it put into law until 2015?
I can't answer the specifics in terms of why the legislation went through. I think that the more so it was turned around as to, you know, what was it trying to avoid? There were people were trying to make sure that they could access what they wanted to without larger institutions that started becoming content companies to potentially have input. So trying to, you know, get some of the cloudiness taken out of there, I think, was why the law came around.
So were we seeing fast lanes starting to emerge? I know there were lawsuits before 2015.
I can't answer to that as much outside of, you know, what's already out there.
So, Kip, if these rules are rolled back, can you give me a concrete example of what might look different for me as an internet user?
So I think what's been proposed is that a lot of the service providers that are putting them through or who are in favor of this, right, want to have the ability to say, okay, we can have an input as to, you know, what content is going where and who's seeing what and what speeds, right? We have to pay for these and these have to generate some money somehow. So a concrete example may be that it could be different sites have agreements where there is preferential. It could, like you use your example that you used of Netflix, it could be the case that Netflix has an agreement with a different provider and that's who is in their tier one category. Things to that effect.
Who is on what side in this debate? Can you tick off some of the big names that people will recognize and where they stand?
Sure. So in favor of the open internet is Google. There are a lot of the ACLU. There's a lot of other different groups. And on the other side, who are looking for more of a closing of the internet is the ISPs. It's the people who actually have to pay for the infrastructure and run and maintain and support them.
One of the arguments that these telecom companies who are in favor of rolling back these regulations have been making in favor of doing just that is that they say net neutrality is inhibiting them from investing in rural internet architecture, that sort of last mile connectivity that some Vermonters are very familiar with. Can you explain the argument that they're making for why net neutrality rules are preventing them from investing in that?
So So the item that you brought up last mile is really tricky, right? Because it's saying what is the ability for to connect someone who is at the very last mile, who's outside of a population area and is in the rural center. Many times it costs a lot more to set that person up for the same cost as to what it would be. So what they're saying is that the economies of scale to get it out to all these people is much harder. They may have to employ new technology. It could take more hours or things along those lines. Therefore, their costs in less populated areas, right, because you don't have clusters of people, go up. So they're looking at it as a business would, which they should, to say, okay, it's going to cost us more money to do this. Therefore, our expansion is inhibited because we can't get out to those areas because our main areas of population are here, and it costs more per person to go out there.
So the argument is basically if we were able to increase our revenue streams through these fast lanes or priority services, we'd have more money to dedicate to this other part of our business?
I think it's a fair assessment to say that they're trying, you know, again, they're in it to both serve a customer as well as to make money. So they're trying to pick out which customers that they can support most effectively.
The FCC submitted its recommendations to the White House yesterday, but these rules are not rolled back yet. It hasn't even gone through all the way. So do you have a sense, Kip, of the timeline here?
No, I think again, they have received a significant amount of comments, so there's going to be some time that it's going to take for them to go through and actually review them, and for committees, again, to see overall what's come out of it and what the overall general consensus is and how they respond to it.
Kip Steele is part of the IT team at UVM Health Network. Thank you very much for being our explainer, Kip. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Bradley Holt works as a developer advocate and senior software engineer with IBM Watson Data Platform, among many other tech credentials. Tom Evslin is former chief technology officer for Vermont, and we have asked them to join us for this discussion now because they have very different positions on the value of net neutrality, and we thought it would be helpful to have these perspectives debated in a clear and constructive way. Bradley and Tom, it's nice to have you here, and I understand you're both operating on your own here, not for any representatives or of any companies, but these are your thoughts that you want to share today. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having us, Jim.
Thank you.
So we'll get deeper into the arguments, but can you give me your top line, your sort of here is my position statement? And Tom, I'll start with you.
Okay, thanks. Just one thing I'd like to correct. Kip did a
Please
great
do.
Job summing things up. There was no legislation in 2015. There was a regulation
by
the FCC.
Regulation.
There is no net neutrality legislation. And that's a point of issue because it's not legally clear whether the FCC had the authority to do that without regulation. But let's leave the legal issue aside and talk about the merits some.
Okay.
So to go back just a little bit, you gave a history, but it was a very recent history.
Yes.
So starting in 2000, when the internet was just beginning to be a force, I had a company that my wife and I had founded that did voice over IP. At the time, the biggest threat to us is that the telephone companies were trying to get the FCC to regulate voice over IP and the internet as if it were the telephone network. Now, remember that regulation of the telephone network led to almost no innovation over a 50-year period. Phones are still brain dead compared to cell phones. So they were the incumbents, and they knew that disruptive technology was a possible threat to them. And obviously I had a commercial interest in that, and those of us who were in the early internet industry, including Google and Amazon, worked very hard to get the FCC to forbear from that regulation. Reed Hunt was an appointee of President Clinton. He was the chairman of the FCC at the time. The FCC agreed to forbear. Then George Bush was elected. We were afraid that a Republican administration would be more friendly to the telcos who still wanted this. They even wanted internet software regulated to make sure it didn't compete with them. We worked with Michael Powell was the new chairman of the FCC, and the FCC actually made a formal decision called the Pulver decision that said voice over IP specifically, and by implication, the internet was not the type of service that Congress had meant to give the FCC jurisdiction over under Title II. They would use what they called a regulatory light touch. Well, they did. Voice over IP flourished. The cost of international phone calls went down by 99%, just what the telcos were afraid of. Google flourished, Amazon flourished. Now we fast forward to 2014. 2014 and then eventually 2015, the same internet companies are now for regulation. Why? I think because they're now the dominant players. The greatest threat to a dominant player isn't the second strongest player. It's somebody with disruptive innovation. And so all of a sudden, who has to gain from regulation? Those who are afraid of innovation because regulation stifles innovation. Surprisingly, Google and Amazon managed to sell the argument that there shouldn't be any internet fast lanes when, in fact, they have internet fast lanes. They're not sold to them by the telephone companies, but they have private networks. So they interface with the internet at many points. They have data warehouses and data caches. So if you go to Netflix or you go to Amazon or you go to Facebook, guess what? Those pages pop really fast. It's not that the telco sold them that service. It's that they have a private network. And then they say piously, well, we could afford to pay for faster access, but we're worried about the little guy. No, wait a minute. The little guy doesn't have a private network, can't start a private network. Ironically, you can get some of the advantages of Amazon's private network if you host on Amazon. The last company I founded did that. And again, I'm not against Google or Amazon. I think they're great, innovative companies, but I think that they've become incumbents. And so now you have this so-called net neutrality regulation that says that the carriers, just as Kip Supply explained it, can't offer a fast lane to content suppliers. They can charge you more for faster access, as we all know, but they can't charge a content supplier more for a fast lane. Well, that means that the only people who could sell me faster access to compete with Amazon or Google, if that's what I want to do, without hosting on one of those services, aren't allowed to sell that service. And not surprisingly, under the 2015 net neutrality regulations, the private networks are not regulated. So it's a very interesting argument. I don't mean to say that it's all black and white. It isn't. Comcast and Verizon and the others would be monopolies if they could be monopolies. But if we look at them on a worldwide scale, they're not nearly as dominant as Google or as Amazon. And it's Google and Amazon that certainly don't need any protection from competition. Once we hoped that Google would provide competition to the last mile providers. Remember, they started a project called Google Fiber. We lobbied very hard to try to get Google Fiber to come to Vermont unsuccessfully. But then Google apparently decided that they wouldn't compete with the telcos that way. And now they're a more powerful lobbying presence, and I think they're competing through regulation rather than competing in the marketplace. I think we're all the losers for that.
All right. So I'm going to give a gross generalization of what you said here. But what I'm hearing from you is that you think, Tom, that net neutrality rules basically favor the incumbents, favor the big companies, not the internet service providers, but the big internet companies where a lot of us are getting content, which already have a workaround to make sure that they're getting to you fast and efficiently and that that's what you're seeing. And so that's why you think they want to keep net neutrality rules around, because it favors them and, you say, perhaps stifles innovation.
You said it much better and much quicker than I did.
Bradley, your turn. What do you think?
Well, I think net neutrality actually, as a rule, creates innovation. It doesn't stifle innovation. And I think if we look at the history of net neutrality, it is certainly complex, and it's a very vast and complex history, but it has been the guiding principle for the internet since the very beginning. And I think the success of that policy is undeniable, that we've seen having the internet as an open platform for free speech and innovation has seen very large companies like Facebook and Google get started. Those companies wouldn't have been nearly as successful as they are if there hadn't been a neutral network for them to operate on. So I think it actually provides a level playing field. It puts startups and large companies on the same level playing field with access to consumers. And it certainly is a complex question, because what we're typically talking about with net neutrality is the last mile access, the ability to have access to the consumers themselves. And there's certainly the issue of data center access and middle mile access. So it certainly gets very complex very quickly. But I don't believe that anybody should be able to purchase priority access to that last mile other than the end consumer themselves if they want a faster internet speed.
So if the idea behind the rule, and the rule is designed to allow this level playing field and to foster creativity so that small companies have the same level playing field as big companies, and they don't have to have a huge bankroll to be able to offer better deals to different sites or software. Is that how it's working in practice, do you think, Bradley? I mean, Tom is saying, sure, that was the idea, but now the big players have found a way to make it work better for them. What do you think?
I think it is working that way in practice. I think that that when it comes to that ability to if I'm a blogger and I want to go publish something on the internet, I have that same level of access as anybody else. Certainly, if I wanted to become a very large company and I wanted to have became very popular, I would certainly need to buy more capacity on the back end, on the data center end of things. But I do have equal access on the consumer facing end, and I think that that spurs innovation and creates that level playing field for companies.
We got a note from Ben, and then I'll come back to you, Tom. Ben says, I'm a student in Vermont studying computer science with an emphasis on web development. Currently, there's a shortage of engineers available to meet the demand for quality websites. If we provide fast lanes, it will only reduce the amount of competition on the web and funnel users to the few sites that can afford it. The removal of net neutrality rules will only hurt budding tech industries in places like Vermont. Tom, I know you were chomping at the bit here. To respond to Bradley.
So let me respond to a couple of things that Bradley said. First of all, the environment that Google, Facebook, and all the others came to age in was before the promulgation of the net neutrality regulations. That was in 2015. All of those companies had grown enormously before 2015. So yes, I agree with you. An unregulated internet, meaning an internet that was not under Title II regulation, where the FCC forbear for regulation, was a wonderful environment for innovation. I gained from it, and many other people did as well. And I'd argue that since 2015, innovation is more difficult, not less difficult. Secondly,
I want to get Bradley. What do you think about that? And then Tom will get your secondly.
Sure. Actually, I think the history is a little bit more complicated than that. We actually have had net neutrality since long before 2015. What happened was there was a federal appeals court ruling in 2014, which basically shot down the FCC's regulation of net neutrality. So we lost net neutrality in 2014. And then at that point, it was after that that the FCC reclassified internet service as a utility, and that allowed them to again regulate net neutrality. So it's a little complicated. We probably couldn't get into all the nuances of the policy in the short time we have here, but by and large, net neutrality has been the policy of the internet since the beginning.
I have to say that's been a part that's been really confusing to me as just a sort of regular consumer.
I really disagree with Bradley on that. It was 2012 or 2013 that the Obama FCC promulgated a regulation on privacy, which is the one that was struck down by the court because of lack of jurisdiction. But it had never had a serious effect because it was stayed and because it was appealed. For the time that the internet grew up from, say, 1999 until 2015, actually, there was no effective regulation of the access providers. The environment that we had the enormous growth in.
One of the things that you keep saying, though, that is so interesting to me is you keep talking about regulation and that, if regulation stifles innovation. What if, though, the regulation, as it is in net neutrality, is not regulating how you have to do what you do? It's just saying you cannot offer a faster speed and therefore, sort of perhaps leave others behind.
There's two things I'd object to. One is the regulation is actually much broader than that. It subjects the whole internet to Title II regulation. And it somewhat surprises me that my friends who are afraid of a growing imperial presidency want to have internet access regulated by presidential appointees, which the FCC is.
Presidential appointees say they will unregulate.
And I think that's a good thing. Usually regulators don't forswear regulation. They like to regulate. But without getting into the politics of it at all, I think that the Title II regulation is much, much broader than just the equal access. And so it's a bad thing in that. But I think secondly, let me give you a couple of examples of why this stifles innovation. Suppose you had a telemedicine application and it really had to be fast. I mean, really fast. Couldn't do it on today's internet. So you're supposed to wait for that application until the whole internet is that fast. What if you paid a little bit more, you, the provider of that application, in order to get the fastest speed? Well, you can't, because that the providers aren't allowed to sell you that faster access. So that you had a news story.
But doesn't that still depend then if you're what your end user has for speed? I mean, you can have the fastest access possible, but if you're
no,
if
but
end
that,
user.
In this argument, that's irrelevant, right? Because okay. We're saying the end users have what the end users have. They pay for what they choose to pay for.
So you have to wait, though, for everybody to get fast internet.
No, you really don't, because access over the backbone is what's important, is one of the things that's important. If the individual subscriber buys the fastest access they can, but the packets get lost on their way or don't get internet speed, then you can't do certain applications. So we can't innovate in those spaces because nobody's allowed to sell us the faster access. You had a news story on just before we sat down. It's absurd, actually, that the first responder community wants to build and will spend millions of dollars building a special purpose network. That's idiocy. That money, a fraction of that money could go into the internet. Yes, they need higher speed or guaranteed speed at times of crisis that the internet can't give them. Why shouldn't that service be available on the internet instead of saying, oh, we've got to build a whole separate network? That's crazy. But we could innovate in that space if we were allowed to innovate in it.
Today, we're looking at the concept of net neutrality and getting two different takes on its value and limitations. The Federal Communications Commission is interested in rolling back some regulations on service providers, so it's a hot topic in tech circles and beyond. We're trying to get to the heart of what net neutrality means for you. We're talking with two knowledgeable people who work or worked in technological fields, but who are speaking today from their own perspectives. Tom Evslin is retired, but used to be chief technology officer for Vermont. Tom also served as Vermont's chief recovery officer after Irene and was founder and CEO of, is it ITXC or
yes.
ITX? Okay, ITXC Corp, a voice over internet protocol provider. Also with us today is Bradley Holt, developer advocate and senior software engineer with IBM Watson Data Platform. He has served as a volunteer on the Burlington Telecom Advisory Committee, the Vermont Community Access Media Board, and was co-founder of a creative services company based in Burlington. So they have a lot of experience in different realms on this subject and some great knowledge that we're learning from today. Bradley, I know you wanted to make a counterpoint to Tom's example before the break.
Sure. So I think there's an example that I could provide where the lack of net neutrality would actually harm innovation. So let's say, for example, that the Comcast were to charge Facebook for priority access to their network. And let's say that Twitter, as a competitor to Facebook, chose not to pay for that priority access. What would happen in that scenario is that the quality of service for Twitter would be degraded relative to Facebook's quality of service. And that would give end users who are paying the same amount of money, they're paying money to their internet service provider, assuming that they're getting equal access to all content. But they're actually given priority access to Facebook in that scenario because Facebook is choosing to give money to Comcast. And I think that puts Twitter at a disadvantage in that scenario. And beyond that, those are large companies, so I'm not so worried about that. But if you had startups who were trying to enter that industry, who wanted to compete with those large players, Facebook and Twitter might be able to afford to buy that priority access. But a small startup would likely not have those resources.
Beyond innovation, as a consumer, you know, let's take, for example, streaming TV and video services. So sometimes you want to have something that you can watch over your satellite dish. Great, you can get it. But let's say you like shows on Netflix, but then sometimes you have to get your shows on Hulu. And other times you have to get your shows on Amazon Prime. And depending on where you live in Vermont, you may have one service provider that is your only option. So if net neutrality rules are rolled back and I want to be able to watch Amazon Prime and Hulu and Netflix, am I going to be at a disadvantage because whatever my internet service provider is might have an agreement with one of those that makes it harder for me to watch the other ones? Is that a scenario that I, as an end user in rural Vermont, may be seeing?
Yes, I think so. And I'm glad you brought up that issue of choice, because if you look at what consumers have access to, about 30% of Americans actually have no choice in their ISP, like in the scenario you provided, and about 40% have only two choices in ISP. So if we're looking for a reason why infrastructure isn't being invested in, isn't being upgraded, it's more likely that the culprit is that lack of competition and the fact that these ISPs do not need to compete with each other and don't need to invest in those infrastructures. So they're looking to extract even more money out of their infrastructure by charging these content providers and giving consumers less access to content, less access to information, and making the internet a less open place and less democratic space.
So, Tom, you know, if for me it sounds like a bad deal, give me the reason why it's not for me as an end user.
It would be a bad deal if you suddenly lost your access to one of those services. And by the way, you notice that when you use Google Chrome, you don't get as good access to things that come from Amazon, but we're not talking about that. And when I use my Amazon Kindle, I can't play my Google Music, but we're not talking about that, right?
Right.
There's a large element of hypocrisy in here.
Yeah.
But what I think—
Isn't there in everything these days?
Yes. Not only these days, probably forever. We just haven't been around forever. I have. You haven't. Is that a possible scenario? Yes. And if it occurred, would we have to deal with it? Yes. And would more competition in internet access help solve that? Yes. Would we get more competition in internet access if internet access providers could also make revenue from fast lanes? Maybe. I can't say that's true. If I'm trying to sell internet access to somebody, most of my market's going to be somewhat competitive, particularly because there's cell phone access as well. And even though some of the same companies sell cell phone access, they do compete in that marketplace where they don't compete in the landline marketplace. And in fact, we now get most of our content through our cell phones. So,
unless you live where I live.
I've worked a long time and I wish I could say successfully, but not completely successfully, to get better internet access in Vermont. But I don't think access providers would be able to sell to their individual customers if they degraded some of the services they delivered so they weren't useful. If some of them already are faster, as I was pointing out. Netflix is faster. Netflix uses a service called Akamai, which caches their content all over the country, just like Amazon has warehouses for its goods. So Netflix content comes to you faster than if I were to start Tom's video streaming service. But we're not, quote, protected from that. So I don't disagree with Bradley that that's a possible scenario and that if it happened, it would be a very bad thing. But I think our best protection about it is to have more competition, both in the content providers and in the service providers, and to think about that analogy between the provider of your cell phone operating system, the provider of your browser, and the provider of your last mile access. Every one of them has a choke point that they can exercise.
Let me get a few calls in here. Richard's calling in from Essex, New York. Hi, Richard. What are you thinking about?
Well, I live in the Adirondacks where I don't have an internet service provider except through satellite, so I have a choice of only two, HughesNet or XD, Viasat. And to be honest, I'd be very deeply skeptical of any company that claimed that somehow eliminating the regulations for net neutrality would somehow benefit me as an end user. In the last mile, you know, we had an incredible system. We developed the most extensive telephone system in the world, and we established rural electrification by having regulated utilities in which they were obligated to provide service to rural America by a government regulation. And I can't see how that money is suddenly going to go to putting fiber optic cable out in the middle of the Adirondacks where I live. And I think the idea of deregulation benefiting us doesn't make sense and isn't proven to be true by just the very experience of the utilities we have. Now, I don't have a DSL line on our telephone, and our landlines haven't been upgraded in decades where I live. But those landlines were the best there was when we had regulated public utilities.
Richard, I appreciate your call, and I want to grapple with that, but let's get another call in here first while we have the space before we get back to our guests. Taylor is on the line with us from Hanover, New Hampshire. Hi, Taylor. Go right ahead.
Hello. It seems so far in this conversation, and probably in many conversations about net neutrality, a bit of a trade-off or a dichotomy is proposed between protecting innovation. I think a perfect example was the medical services network that was proposed, being kind of a waste of money in the regulated environment, versus sort of protecting the little guy and making sure that small companies can have an opportunity to compete with large players like Microsoft or Amazon. And that kind of proposes, I guess, sort of a distinction between like an open, free, flat internet and an internet with kind of lots of off-ramps and on-ramps and HOV lanes, so to speak, for like maximum market efficiency. And I'm just wondering if there's a way to approach this problem that kind of comes at it from a different angle and doesn't present that sort of trade-off, or if there are any kind of novel approaches that are being considered outside of the current framework for net neutrality.
Taylor, I appreciate that inquiry, too. What an interesting way to think about it. So, Bradley, let me go to you first, your thoughts, and then maybe you can dovetail into what both Taylor and Richard were talking about.
Sure. I think the big question we need to wrestle with here is, and this is what the FCC is wrestling with, is the internet a utility or not? And I think it is a utility, like electricity, like water, like telephone service, the way Richard described it. And there are so many things that we rely on the internet for today. For example, applying for a job or paying bills. Those are just a few day-to-day tasks that people rely on the internet for. And if people who are listening to this aren't convinced that the internet is a utility, I would encourage them to unplug their cable, unplug their internet for the next 24 hours and then reconsider. And in fact, many people are probably listening to this broadcast right now, streaming over their internet service.
So what about this idea that Taylor says about, can we look at it from a different perspective, not yes or no, net neutrality or not, but find some way to create that innovation, but not, you know, and the interesting thing for me is you're both saying innovation is key and you can get it this way. And then the other one is saying, no, innovation is key. You can get it the other way. So, you know, what about that idea that Taylor's saying, come on, there's got to be some way to do sort of make it fair and get innovation.
So I think the question is, where are we going to have the most amount of innovation? Are we going to have the most amount of innovation in telecom by deregulating telecom? Or are we going to have more innovation by regulating telecom and providing a level playing field for other industries to innovate on top of telecom? And if we have telecom as a utility, it provides that platform for larger innovation and for greater good and for democratization of access to information and voices and unique perspectives. So for me, the greater good is in that. Even if it does regulate and provide more regulation at the internet service provider level, I think that's a worthy trade-off for the larger amount of innovation that we'll see built on top of that open platform.
Tom?
I think it's a fascinating question, and I think there's an answer to it. When we hear – just listening to the callers, the biggest problems, at least in rural areas, are lack of access completely, or in some cases lack of any kind of fast access. I know how awful it is to be on satellite, and I have a lot of sympathy for the caller on satellite. In other cases, the lack of competition in access. Those are real problems. So how do we address that? I think we address it by making it easier to be in the access business because there's not enough competition in access. And fortunately, the trends in technology are making that possible. There could be some regulation about interconnection with fixed networks that made it even easier. I'm not against all regulation, but you have to understand what you're doing. But I think people talk about everything from drone-based internet access, which would not be as slow as satellite-based, low Earth orbit satellites, which would be faster than high Earth orbits. There's the Internet of Things. There are mesh networks and the fact that wireless is getting better and better and better. So I think that by regulating internet access, not regulating the rest of the things around the internet, not regulating the rest of the choke points, which I don't want to regulate, I think we're making it less likely that we get innovation exactly where we need it, in access, so that more people can have better access and so that there'll be enough access choices that no access provider would dare to exercise monopoly power to degrade somebody's service.
Wow, this was an interesting conversation. Tom Evslin is former chief technology officer for Vermont. Bradley Holt is a developer advocate and senior software engineer. Thank you both for really an illuminating conversation. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us. And thank you, Bradley.
Thank you.